With your Amex card, entertainment benefits like special ticket access and pre-sales to select can't-miss events while supplies last, make every tap music to your ears.
As the number one audio company, iHeartMedia gives you access to all. Every audience, live conversations, trusted influencers, and the insights and data you need to grow. iHeartMedia is your access company. Go to iHeartResults.com for more.
Check the backseat. Check the backseat.
All right, come here.
Check the backseat.
Gets in your head, right? Good. Because every year, dozens of children are forgotten in the backseat of a car by a parent or caregiver. All never thought it could happen to them. But with changes in routines, distractions, or a sleeping child, it can happen to anyone. Parked cars get hot, fast, and can be deadly. So get it in your head.
Check the backseat.
A message from NHTSA and the Ad Council.
If you love sports and true crime, then there's a new podcast from executive producer Dan Patrick and hosted by me, Jay Harris, that you won't want to miss. Playing Dirty Sports Scandals. Each week, I'm squeezing the juiciest details from some of the biggest sports scandals ever. I'm talking Marcus Dixon, Olympic gymnastics, Cain Velasquez, salacious Super Bowl-level scandals. Join me on the dark side of sports by listening to Playing Dirty Sports Scandals on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
What's up, everybody? This is Stephen A. Smith, host of the Stephen A. Smith Show podcast. Tune in every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday at the very least as I bring you all new episodes that feature the biggest headlines in the world of sports, pop culture, business, and I answer your phone calls and respond to your tweets. You'll hear my unfiltered opinions and straight-shooter interviews with top celebrities and game changers, all that and more. So listen to the Stephen A. Smith Show podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
All right, welcome in. It's the MMQB podcast with Albert Breer. It's a little bit of a different week, so the show's going to be a little different. We usually try to keep it to football here, stay in our lane. We don't go outside the lines all that much because I know you're here for football. And I love football, and I want to give you football. Obviously, this week's a different week in our country, so we're going to have football involved in the show today. It's just going to be sort of woven into everything else that we do. And, I just want to start with first pointing people to my column on Monday that I wrote that sort of explains my viewpoint on this whole thing and kind of, you know, how it hit me a different way over the weekend. When my five-year-old saw a car on fire on the TV and I had to explain it to him, and I thought to myself, like, for, you know, a lot of the guys I grew up with, how much more difficult and complicated of a conversation that must be. You know, and then, you know, you sort of start to go through things and you think through some things in your head and, sort of comparing yourself to the circumstances of other people. And I started to think about all the second chances I got. And, a big part of that was because my parents and, the environment I grew up in. You didn't need to be a straight A student from my high school to go to a good college. You didn't I didn't worry about there being food on the table. I didn't worry about things a lot of kids have to worry about. But I also got second chances in different ways along the way. And I wasn't an easy kid to deal with, but, you know, I get into fights when I was a little kid. I got into trouble when I was a little kid. I did dumb shit when I was in high school, same in college. I got busted doing a bunch of stuff. I got cut breaks by police officers. I've gotten cut breaks in courtrooms before. Like, I've gotten cut breaks before doing stuff that was sort of chalked up as, oh, he's a dumbass. And then, you know, when you kind of look at that, and I kind of like considered some of the stuff that I was able to kind of work through when I was a young kid, you know, I started to think about how, you know, other people aren't given the same chances, and how, you know, when somebody else gets pulled over by a police officer, they're viewed differently than it maybe I was viewed when I was 16 or 18 or 20 or 22 years old. And how I wouldn't have been seen as a threat in the same situation that George Floyd was in when he was murdered last week. And so, you know, I just sort of start to think about how, you know, we subconsciously view people and how people are subconsciously viewed. And, you know, if you want to bring that home and into an NFL context, how a lot of these guys make millions of dollars, are the very best in the world at what they do, and still are subjected to a lot of this, even as adults. It's so clear that some change needs to be made. And it's such a massive thing, changing the way people think and changing the way people behave. But You know, I know that there's more that we all can do to get there, and hopefully, you know, this is a flashpoint in our in the history of our country where we all start to do a little bit more. We're going to get to the takeaways now, and the first takeaway is going to sort of connect to that. And again, this was sort of off of a conversation that I had with Richard Sherman over the weekend. And we went back and forth a little bit on everything that's happening. And, you know, he mentioned, how much he appreciated what the white quarterbacks have done and the difference it makes. And I thought that this was an important point that I wanted to reiterate here. And it's not just the white quarterbacks, the quarterbacks in general, but it's the white quarterbacks because they reach a different audience. And quarterbacks have generally been so careful in the past about the way that they come off and reaching the most broad audience. And in a way, in a lot of ways, there are parallels to Michael Jordan with the quarterbacks because they are brands and they are trying to sell to everybody and they are trying to appeal to everybody. And so, you know, I think the fact that those guys stepped out and said and basically took up for their teammates. And I don't think there's a right. To me, like, there's not even two sides to this. There's just a right side and the other side. But, you know, for Joe Burrow and Trevor Lawrence, who's not in the NFL yet, but will be next year, you know, for Carson Wentz and for Andy Dalton to come out and say something, I think there was real power in that. And that was something that Richard Sherman pointed out to me, that, you know, the ability to reach it, that to get that message to a different audience and to make sure that a different audience hears that message. To me, like, I think there's great power in that, and it's great that that's happening. And I think one thing that we need to keep keep in mind with that too is, like, look at the age of the guys who are talking out. Now, I believe Carson Wentz was first to speak out, but after that you had a rookie in Joe Burrow, and then you had a guy who's not even in the league yet in Trevor Lawrence. And then after that, you had Andy Dalton, who's a little bit older, but the floodgates had sort of opened at that point. And so if there's one thing that was encouraging about that, beyond just getting the message to a new audience, I think it's also that the younger generation maybe has a better handle on all of this stuff than, you know, some guys who are closer to my age, or, you know, there are a couple quarterbacks who are actually older than me. You know, it's just sort of the fact that the younger guys are really, like, I feel comfortable at that age, you know, stepping into this arena and speaking that way, I think is a good sign for where our country's going. Takeaway number two, and it's not going to be easy transition here, but I did want to bring up Rob Gronkowski. He is no longer the WWE's 24/7 champion. He, like, and I'm going to read this directly off the news story. Believe it or not, this was a news story on ESPN.com. After his 58 days of holding gold, Rob Gronkowski's championship reign in the WWE has officially come to an end. WWE aired a vignette Monday that showed Gronkowski walking into his backyard in Foxborough, Massachusetts. R-Truth, who has been the most prolific holder of the WWE 24/7 title since its inception in May 2019, so that title, I guess, is 13 months old, won the belt for the 36th time by disguising himself as a landscaper and blindsiding Gronkowski for the pin. Now, I didn't know this, and I saw the way he won the belt in the first place, but apparently this belt, the whole concept of it is that you can lose it or win it at any time, so people can do these sorts of things. All right, the larger point here, I can't wait to see what Gronk's like in Tampa, because he's going to have the freedom now to do and say whatever he wants. And not that he didn't have some of that in New England, but I think the only time we really saw the full scope of it was when he was in conflict with the team, like during the motocross press conference. That's the only time we really saw it. So it's going to be exciting to see what Rob Gronkowski looks like in Tampa. Takeaway number three. DeSean Jackson, actually the Eagles wide receiver, told ESPN's Outside the Lines, "I think they should mic up players. They should give fans the insight to what really goes on between the white lines if there aren't going to be fans in the stands." I love the thought from DeSean Jackson. I don't think it's going to happen, and there are a couple reasons why. Number one, it affects the strategy of the game, and I do think that that's one thing. You know, when I watched some of the German soccer the last couple of weeks, you could hear the crowd. You could hear the players conversing, I think, that first week, and then they piped in the crowd noise, and you really couldn't. And you'd hear it so clearly that I think it's got a way where it's going to affect the strategy of the game, affect the communication. And so, you know, I think that the idea that they'd have that in real time could create a competitive problem in the NFL. Here's the other thing. They don't need to. The reason why leagues like the AAF and the XFL have done stuff like this is because they sort of have to do it to draw fans in. Now, the NFL can create content by miking people up, but most of that stuff is aired long after the games are over. I don't think they need to do anything extra to get people, you know, sort of through the virtual turnstile to turn on their TV and watch the game. The game's ratings are what they are, which is, you know, it's the highest, you know, it's the most successful television product in sports in America. And so they don't need to do it. There's a competitive element that's compromised. I love Deshaun Jackson's idea. I'd love to see it, to be clear about it, but I don't think it's happening. Number four, takeaway number four. This is interesting to me. Case Keenum, new Cleveland Brown. Baker Mayfield said on Wednesday in a video call, that is a huge part of why I was looking forward to being around Case, learning the offense. He was in the system, so I can hear his thoughts on how it is taught and how he reads it. And so I think that the Baker Mayfield saying that isn't like, you know, earth-shattering. It's not the biggest deal in the world seeing him say that. But I do think it underscores kind of the problem that Andy Dalton and Joe Flacco and Cam Newton and Jameis Winston were going to have finding jobs this offseason. There was no question what Case Keenum was coming in. They knew he was a backup, and he could be sort of a resource to the starter. And I think a lot of these teams that have younger quarterbacks, they want the older quarterback they bring in to be a resource, not a threat to the starter. Case Keenum, he is a resource to Baker Mayfield. Joe Flacco can be a resource to Sam Darnold. There might be some question over whether or not he'd be willing to do that, but the fact that he had a relationship with Joe Douglas, the general manager there, makes it easier to sell. Brian Hoyer can be a great resource to Jared Stidham in New England. Mike Glennon can be a good resource to Gardner Minshew in Jacksonville. And so I think that's something that a lot of people have missed, is the idea that the backup quarterback job description is a lot different than the job description for a starting quarterback. And the starting quarterback, you want the best player you can get. The backup quarterback, you can approach it a couple different ways. And clearly the Browns have decided to approach that backup quarterback spot in creating a resource for Baker Mayfield rather than creating any sort of threat to him. Finally, takeaway number five. I just want to make sure that I did mention here in the podcast, you know, Colin Kaepernick was, I think, a sort of ahead of his time. And, you know, you look at the difference that he made, and we can argue about his method, and we can argue about why he's in the league, why he's not in the league. Clearly, you know, the anthem protest was a part of the equation there, no doubt about it. You know, but there's no question that he's going to be, you know, remembered for this. And, you know, the fact that he was talking out about something that became such a, I mean, just mushroomed in the 4 years, you know, after, you know, he got done playing, the impact he's made obviously is big. You know, again, like, I think that there's, you know, different arguments about his method. I think the one thing that I do think that is important that everybody remembers here, very important that everybody remembers here about that part of it, and then we'll go to our guest, is that summer, Colin Kaepernick initially was sitting down for the anthem on the bench. That August, for the first couple preseason games, I think, for the Niners, he was sitting on the bench, and there was huge backlash. And he actually wound up going to Nate Boyer, who was an Army Ranger, who was a long snapper at Texas, who now has gotten involved in training players with Jay Glazer in L.A. He went to Nate Boyer and basically asked Nate Boyer what the respectful thing would be to do. And Nate Boyer was the one who told him kneeling would be the respectful way to peacefully protest. And so I just think it's important we remember where that came from, where the idea of it came from. It came from an Army Ranger. You know, and, you know, I think that in the end, you know, the the impact that he made in giving other athletes cover to speak out on these issues. I think we felt that over the last 6 or 7 days, and even giving somebody like Jed York, who I think is genuinely wants to do the right thing, the 49ers owner, and there are a lot of owners that have done the wrong thing. The league office can't get out of its own way on a lot of this stuff. But, you know, it set Jed York up in a lot of ways to be one of the leading voices in the league on social justice. And now, you know, when he puts out a statement, I take it at its face. I take it as something that he really means. Whereas with other guys, you wonder how many PR people it went through. You know, you see what Jed York says, and I do think that there's meaning behind it. And so that's the lasting impact that Colin Kaepernick has had that I think has been felt this week, is so many more athletes feel comfortable to speak out. And so many, you know, people who were in that organization at that time were affected by it. And I think now have the ability to speak from a place of authority on it. All right, we'll get to our special guest right after this.
Snakes, zombies, sharks, heights, speaking in public. The list of fears is endless. But while you're clutching your blanket in the dark, wondering if that sound in the hall was actually a footstep, the real danger is in your hand when you're behind the wheel. And while you might think a great white shark is scary, what's really terrifying and even deadly is distracted driving. Eyes forward, don't drive distracted. Brought to you by NHTSA and the Ad Council.
If you love sports and true crime, then there's a new podcast from executive producer Dan Patrick and hosted by me, Jay Harris, that you won't want to miss. Playing Dirty Sports Scandals. Each week, I'm squeezing the juiciest details from some of the biggest sports scandals ever. I'm talking Marcus Dixon, Olympic gymnastics, Cain Velasquez, salacious Super Bowl-level scandals. Join me on the dark side of sports by listening to Playing Dirty Sports Scandals on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
What's up, everybody? This is Stephen A. Smith. When I'm not at my day job, First Take, you can find me in my studio hosting the Stephen A. Smith Show podcast. Tune in every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, at the very least, as I bring you all new episodes that feature the biggest headlines in the world of sports, pop culture, business, and politics. You'll hear my unfiltered opinions on those nauseating Cowboy fans, the chaos in Washington, D.C., and trending topics on social media, as well as my straight shooter interviews with top celebrities and game changers. And I occasionally give out love advice. Yes, it's true. If you want to know my true feelings about something, I'll give it to you straight. So listen to the Stephen A. Smith Show podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcast.
Hey, everyone. This is Molly and Matt, and we're the hosts of Grown Up Stuff, How to Adult, a podcast from Ruby Studio and iHeart Podcasts.
It's a show dedicated to helping you figure out the trickiest parts of adulting.
Like how to start planning for retirement, creating a healthy skincare routine, understanding when and how much to tip someone, and so much more.
Here's a clip from an upcoming episode featuring the weekly home checks, Keyshawn Lane, that you won't want to miss.
A common mistake that a lot of people do, they use fabric softener when it's not so great for your clothes.
Should we never be using fabric softener?
No, you should not ever be using fabric softener. Wow. It leaves a deposit on our clothes, which is also left in the machine. And it also makes the clothes highly flammable.
Wait, what?
Yes. What you want to do instead is just use a quarter cup of vinegar.
And that'll make them softer?
That'll make them softer. And if you wanted some kind of scent, you can use essential oils.
Wow, wow, wow. Catch new episodes of Grown Up Stuff, How to Adult every other Tuesday on the iHeartRadio app or wherever you get your podcasts. Grown Up
Stuff. MTV's official Challenge podcast is back for another season.
And guess what? So are we.
Just in case you forgot, I'm Tori Deal. I'm a 6-time finalist and a Challenge champion.
And I'm Anissa Ferrer, and I've been gracing your screens for the last 2 decades. I am a veteran challenger and Challenge All-Star.
And speaking of All-Stars, All-Stars 4 is finally here.
I'm going to be honest. I literally thought this day was never going to come. Well, the challenge gods have answered our prayers, and we're going to be right here along with you fans covering every episode on the podcast.
And this season takes it to a whole new level. Old school legends, modern power players, redemption seekers, and ex-lovers are all competing in Cape Town, South Africa for the prize of $300,000.
Anyone can win, relationships matter, and only one all-star will claim the title of Challenge Champion.
Listen to MTV's official Challenge podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
All right, so we're going to bring in one of my favorite guys in 15 years of covering the NFL, and a guy who was a high profile player for a long time, played for the Patriots, the Eagles, the Saints, the Browns, the Ravens, and the Redskins. I want to make sure I didn't miss anybody there, Dante.
Be here all night.
But one thing that's really interesting about Dante Stallworth, and we'll bring him in now, is just how he always had this curiosity outside of football, and it's really led him to, now kind of a second career, talking about politics, talking about, issues globally on television. So CNN contributor now, Dante Stallworth, welcome in.
Hey, Al, thanks for having me on, brother.
All right, so here's where I want to start. And I don't know that everybody who isn't following Dante should be, so it's at Dante Stallworth on Twitter, but if you're following him, you saw last night that he was sort of in the middle of everything in Lafayette Park. And if you can, Dante, just sort of, and Lafayette Park is the area just north of the White House, I believe, right? Like right near the church. I wanted to give you the chance to kind of explain, when you got there, what it was like, how the protests went. And then, B, of course, how everything kind of came apart at the end.
Yeah, so I think this entire weekend has been pretty tense, not just in Washington, D.C., where I live, but all around the country, for the killing of George Floyd in Minneapolis, where four police officers bounded him down and held him down. The officer who was just recently charged with third-degree murder was the one who kneeled on his neck for an extended period of time, more than 7 minutes. And after he lost consciousness, the knee stayed there for another couple of minutes. So people have been outraged about this entire situation, and it's boiled over. We are in a pandemic right now. We're dealing with a global crisis of COVID-19, unprecedented in our times. The economy is faltering right now. We're in a period where we have in the last 10 weeks where more than 40 million Americans have filed for unemployment. And within that same exact 10 weeks, billionaires have amassed close to $500 billion, while more than 40 million Americans have filed for unemployment. So there's genuine anger, genuine frustration of what is happening in this country and what has been happening for a long time, I think has now boiled over to the top with the killing of George Floyd being the straw that broke the camel's back. So fast forward to yesterday, I was out there. I live in Washington, D.C. I live in the downtown area. So Lafayette Park is essentially where whenever there's a protest in D.C., people will go there to protest. They'll protest in other places, but it's not necessarily always about the president when people protest there. So this has I've been here for 6 years. This has a much longer than that tradition of people protesting their head of government's residence. So that's what we do here in this country. That's what this country was partly founded on, was protesting. So there are people out there protesting, and the barriers had been pushed back. They allowed us to get closer Thursday, Friday, Saturday. We were up on the White House fences near the sidewalk. But yesterday they had the barriers out all the way to basically the entrance of Lafayette Park. Lafayette Park is essentially on White House grounds, but it's protected by the Secret Service. And it's a pretty nice sized park. And so the National Guard was called in, as you know, and Trump said throughout the country that he wanted the governors to get a hold on everything that was happening. And his issue is that he's conflating the protests with some of the more uprisings, the rebellions, if you will, that we've been seeing late at night with the fires and the looting and the windows being broke. He's conflating the two. So when we were out there, and I'd sent you the video prior to this interview, Al.
Yep.
You know, we were right out there, and initially, I would say curfew was at 7 p.m. yesterday. So initially, the police began, the riot police began to push back the protesters who were peacefully protesting. People were peacefully protesting, right? Like,
so really quickly, how far, like these are the barriers. They were right up against the White House before. Like, how far are you from the actual White House now? Like how far back were they from that actual wall that kind of protects the White House?
So they're building a new fence now that's much higher. I think it's going to be 12 or 15 feet high now because people were jumping the normal 6 feet, not during this protest. You're not allowed to get that close anymore. But over the last 6 years since I've been here, I've seen it happen multiple times. So they wanted to make the fence higher. So you have that barrier. Then you have the sidewalk. And then you have a street. The street was open prior to the Al-Qaeda bombings of the U.S. embassies in Africa at the end of the 90s. That street was open. So it's an actual street.
Right.
So the police, the barricade started on the other side of the street. So they had the entire street, their pretty big sidewalk, and then you have the White House huge fence, and then the White House is, I don't know, maybe 40 yards from the fence to the actual house. So we were a ways away. We were a ways away. We were much closer on Friday when Trump went and he was ushered to his bunker, which made him upset that that those reports were leaked. Was that he was rushed to his bunker on Friday night when people were protesting, and then that's when they started macing the protesters again. I have all that on video.
So
this was at 3:30 in the morning on Friday night, Saturday morning.
Did you notice, like, so we all know about like the conference call, right, that happened with the president and the governors on Monday?
Yes.
And you said you were out there Friday, Saturday, Sunday, Monday, right? So you were out there each of the 4 days. Was there a different? I mean, before anything actually happened, was there any sort of change in tone between the protesters and the police on Monday? Did it feel different at all going there versus what it had been over the weekend?
So here's the thing. I think everyone has seen the images across the country of police escalating this situation. Mm-hmm. Police have escalated the situation. It's clear that they have. People obviously have been busting windows and property damage and things like that. But if you notice it, a lot of that seems to be in the response to what the police have been doing, not just in Washington D.C. and Minneapolis, but all across the country. You're seeing in Seattle, where their police department pushed down this old man who could barely walk and he had a cane, and they pushed him down. So, you know, it's been happening all around the country, or where the horse trampled this young lady in Texas.
Yeah.
And so people have been upset about that. But, you know, again, there's video that I have of, and I'm pretty close to the front. There's video that, just before, I think most people saw the images when Trump came out to speak at the Rose Garden, was when the police made the, offensive to push back the protesters. And you see the images of them swinging their shields and hitting people with batons and firing rubber bullets and firing tear gas, which is illegal use of a chemical weapon in war. But yet it's okay to use that on our citizens. Go figure.
Were you aware that, like, so the president spoke, or he's supposed to speak, I think at 6, right? And then he wound up speaking at 6:30. And I think, like, what kind of stuck out for all of us who were watching on TV, who weren't there, was kind of like how it seemed timed up, and the whole thing seemed staged. Were you aware? I mean, maybe not so much you, because I know you're really in tune to this, but were people there aware that the president was about to get up and speak and that something might happen.
No, I don't think so. And you know, if you've seen the images, I didn't see this until I got back home with the two images, one of Trump saying he's a law and order president and he sides with peaceful protesters. And yet on the other split screen, on the other side of the split screen is when you exactly at that moment was when the police started to hit people with shields and batons and firing tear gas. And so, you know, that's who he wants to be. That's who he's always been. If anyone who's listened to him when he first started, campaigning, that's who he wanted to be. He wanted to be this, as he calls him, a strong man. He's shown affinity for authoritarian figures all around the world, heads of state from Turkey to with Erdogan, from the Philippines with Rodrigo Duterte, with Vladimir Putin, and obviously his relationship with Kim Jong-un. Now, listen, I'm a very peaceful person, and I'm okay with him talking with these people. I'm okay with that because we've done it. We've worked with dictatorships throughout our history. However, is when you start to show an affinity for them, these anti-democratic institutions, when you become friendly with these people and start to show an affinity towards them and you bring it home, that's the problem. Yeah. And so that's what he wanted. That's what he's always wanted to be. And that picture, that image of him saying those things while they're gaslighting the country, because in the other split screen where they showed that the police state agents were pushing back the protesters and firing tear gas, you know, and unprovoked. And this was about a half an hour before curfew. So no one had did anything to provoke them. The only logical conclusion that one could come to was that this is exactly what the president wanted to happen.
To the people like there, like that were on the ground, like, well, let me ask you this first. Was it a completely peaceful protest? Was it, I mean, the images you sent me kind of reflected that where everybody took the knee, like, give people listening an idea of like what the scene was like before, right before, like 6:15, 6:20, 6:25, like what the scene was like right before everything happened.
So it was a peaceful protest all the way through. I'd been out there for a couple of hours at that time. People were chanting the slogan, "Say her name, Breonna Taylor." They were saying, chanting, "Say his name, George Floyd." Ahmaud Arbery, there were a lot of chants, a lot of Black Lives Matter chants, no justice, no peace. All these chants that were kind of born out of the civil rights era that we're still using today. It became, the protests became violent, or the start of the violence, when I believe on my phone the ticker says 6:12. So this is maybe about 40 minutes before curfew,
right?
About 10 minutes before Trump came to the Rose Garden. People were standing near that entrance, which is, I don't know, it could be 100 yards, 80 yards from the Rose Garden to where people were standing. So it's not close at all.
Right.
However, before Trump could go out there, they had to clear the people out of there. So there's images of police swinging their batons. I was right there. I didn't get the police officer swinging on the baton, but I caught the end commotion where they hit a guy upside the head and he was just bleeding out of his forehead. I posted it on Twitter because I wanted people to see what was happening. And everyone's saying like, "Hey, there's kids out here. There's children. This is a peaceful protest." And it's close, you know, it's little less than an hour before curfew. So what are you guys doing? And so they came out and they became more aggressive, and they came out by the dozens. They started piling out of the White House. And, and then that's when they became aggressive and started pushing us back towards the church. They started pushing us back towards the church area because that street is very long and they're not going to push us to 15th Street.
Right.
So what their best way to do it is to push us back towards the where all the other protesters are, which is on 8th Street. And so they were pushing us all the way back out of the street, all the way back, and pushing us back through the park. And that's when, I'm sorry, not the park, through the street. And so that's when, you know, about 10 minutes later, when they kept pushing and kept pushing. And then I would say about 6:34 is when the police officer started to really like make an offensive, forcibly, violently, swinging their shields and hitting people in the face, batons being swung everywhere, tear gas and rubber bullets people were being pelted with. And I
did the escalation seem coordinated? Like, did it seem like almost they were getting an order? You know what I mean? Like, was it steady?
No. You know, it's funny because, you know, like you alluded to, I knew that Trump was about to speak, right?
Yeah.
And I knew he was speaking at the Rose Garden. So, but I didn't know this until they pushed us back. People were texting me and telling me, hey, you know, something's about to happen because the president is going to speak. And so I'm like, okay, well, that's why they like pushed us back initially from the side of the Rose Garden where they hit the guy in the head with the baton. And then about 10 minutes later, about 10 minutes later is when they became violent. And I mean, look, everyone saw it on television when he was speaking. If you saw a split screen of the protesters, you saw as he began to speak, that was the time. It was, I mean, here's the thing. There has to be that coordination. That's the only logical conclusion, because that's what Trump wanted to happen. That's who he's always been. And I say that's the only logical conclusion because the split screen told the truth. We're not, you know, he says he believes in peaceful protesting, and he stands on the side of peaceful protesters. But yet, in that juxtaposition, you'd see on the split screen image where at that moment, Albert, at that very moment was when the police began to push people back, to swing their shields and baton. I mean, they even, like, somebody fell and then another person went back to pick that person up, and they pushed that, they like shoved that person over and shoved them to the ground face first. This is not, I didn't expect that to happen, to be honest with you. I guess I let my imagination not get the best of me, and usually that doesn't happen, but I didn't expect that. Not even with Trump, I didn't expect that to happen. But
well, yeah, because you expect the individual police officers maybe to think to themselves, okay, like, I know I have my orders, but I'm going to be reasonable about this, right? Like, I don't know, like, there's that part of it, right? Like, which is, these aren't robots, like, they're individual people, you know, and you want to think more. And I know a lot of police officers who've done a lot of good and are good people, and it's just, you want to think that's not what's happening, but clearly, I don't know. I mean, like, just from what we saw on TV, it looked like just bedlam.
It was terrible, man. I was not expecting that to happen. And it made sense when they pushed us back towards the church first, and then they made us go down Vermont Street, which is where the church is, on the corner of Vermont and 8th Street. And then Lafayette Park is right across the street there, and that's where basically the White House is. That was interesting, man. That was something that, you know, I try to have empathy with people around the world, especially when our country is affecting some of the things that are happening around the world in certain countries. And, you know, they weren't firing any live round actual bullets at us, but they were firing tear gas. They were violent towards the protesters up front, pushing the line back, and they were firing tear gas again, which is illegal use of a chemical agent in war. It just made me sad, not just for my country, but it made me sad for people around the world who have to deal with this, you know, with dictators who are shooting live bullets and, you know, who don't have the constitutional and democratic institutions that we've had in this country, where you're not allowed to do certain things. But, you know, since Trump came in as president, he has not really cared about that type of law and order. It's only the aggressive police state law and order that he clings to.
I'm just wondering, like, what the aftermath was like. Like, once they pushed everybody back, like, what was the scene like on the street?
People were mad. People were upset. We couldn't believe that was happening. And I mean, you know, in that moment, people are upset. People are yelling, cursing. But you know, what do? You can't fight back. You're what they were doing fighting back was peacefully protesting. And right. So when they're becoming violent, people become angry. But there was a young lady that had a microphone there, and there were a couple people who threw some water bottles, but, you know, it's a water bottle. They have shields, and it's, you know, they have protective gear. I'm not condoning that, but I'm just saying it's not like that when people say there was violence, like, no, there's not. Throwing a water bottle at a police officer who has a shield and who has protection and they're all protected, that's not violence. Violence is hitting people in the head who are unprotected with shields, hitting them in the face, hitting them in the heads with batons and in the backs, firing rubber bullets at their eyes. Journalists have lost, and people have lost eyes to these rubber bullets that have been flying, tear gas. Again, which I can't stress enough, it's an illegal use of a chemical agent in war. How the hell are we using this in our streets? And people are okay with it. But it became, the young lady said, hey, if you want to be violent, take your ass home, because that's not what we're here to do. We're not here to provoke them. And she took charge. I don't know what her name was. I don't know who she was, but she took charge, and people listened. And that's, I think, you know, they continued to push us down the street past the church. And it made sense why they stopped, which I thought, okay, they're actually cool. They're calming down now. But they were basically there to hold us because Trump was one block up the street at the church where they had just pushed us back from.
That's gotta be frustrating too. Cause it's just like, if it's a non-violent, the violence is coming from that end is, yeah, that sucks. You know, like, that it's a nonviolent protest and like there's violence coming from the other end. Is there a lasting image? Is there something that, I don't know if it kept you awake last night, but something that maybe you'll remember from what that afternoon was like?
Yeah, I think just the mayhem of, you know, kind of learning about things in real time. You know, when they said Trump was given the speech at the Rose Garden, we had already been pushed back from that. And I don't want to say that area, because again, it's like where Trump was speaking was at least 80 yards away from where we were standing, at least. And then you're talking about barricades, you know, multiple barricades, fences in between, and obviously dozens and dozens of police state agents in between us in that area. So we weren't anywhere near that, but just the surreal aspect of them pushing us back when Trump was coming out to speak, and then they became extremely violent when they decided to, I couldn't believe it. That will probably stick with me for a while, because these are the things that you see happen in other countries. These are the things that, you know, are not supposed to happen in this country because we're the quote unquote greatest country in the world.
Yeah.
You know, and just being a part of that, man, was really something. I felt like I was isolated in time. Like I was,
well, you can say, I mean, it didn't feel like America.
No, not, or at least what we perceived to be as America.
Right.
You know, like
what we'd like America to be.
Right. Dr. Martin Luther King was marching in, you know, they got beat just for marching across the bridge. So, you know, I was sitting there in disbelief initially, but then I just fell back like everyone else did. Again, we had no choice, but I just fell back and I just wanted to keep recording, to see if, you know, if I could, capture anything on camera that would be worthy to helping to stop this violence from the police, this escalation from the police, because we have to be clear about one thing. It is violence. This is violence we're doing. And that's something that, you know, their initial job is there to protect, serve and protect is what their motto is.
I just want to like, I'm just wondering, did you notice anything between the police and the church clergy? Because it at least has gotten out there that wasn't exactly pretty either.
No, I didn't.
Okay.
You know, the church had been boarded up that day. I think it got boarded up either earlier that morning or the night before. But yeah, I didn't see any of that. I actually had heard anything, but I can imagine.
Okay. You know, that's unbelievable. It's more than I thought that I'd hear. I mean, it's just crazy to think about like what that must have been like to be there. You know, I want to ask you, Dante, just for, because you are, you know, an athlete, you were an athlete too. You know, like just kind of like how you see a pro athlete's responsibility. I've gotten different answers from different guys on this, like whether or not it's a pro athlete's responsibility to say something, you know, and sort of what role that you think, you know, like just let's say I'm a 23-year-old NFL player who's still trying to kind of figure things out. Mm-hmm. And I ask you, like, what's my responsibility here? What should I be doing? How would you answer that?
I think that's a difficult question. I'd hate to say, you know, everyone should have autonomy of their own selves. And, you know, and if they feel comfortable enough to speak, then speak. If you don't, then don't. But, you know, what happens when too many people are not speaking? You know, Dr. Martin Luther King once told us that silence is betrayal. So, you know, in the face of what's happening today, especially. So it's a difficult question. One thing I can say, though, is, you know, that if everyone should educate themselves on what's happening in this country and what's been happening in this country for a very long time, since the founding, necessarily, just it's important to educate yourself and to understand why these things are still happening, and to then form your own opinions. And if you want to work with groups, you know, educate yourself on which groups that you think that are beneficial to the part of the movement that you want to be in. It's difficult for me to say that, you know, everyone should be speaking out. I would love for that to happen, but I will say that I am happy to see that more people are starting to speak out, and especially, you know, like specifically like white quarterbacks. And
right.
I've always had a big mouth, even ever since I was a kid. So I've always spoken out, even when I didn't know what the hell I was talking about. I've always spoken out. So I've never had that problem, but I do appreciate them taking the time to speak out, because, you know, 70, close to 3/4 of the league is black. Is comprised of black players. So, you know, you're in a locker room with these guys all the time. And when you start to hear these generalizations about how black people act, or the generalizations in general about how black people are, and you're like, wait a minute, like, I work with a lot of these dudes and they're just like I am. They have families who love them. They love their families. They go to work, they come work hard, and they go home. And so I've really appreciated guys like Andy Dalton and especially Joe Burrow, man. Like, I definitely appreciate him. And no one can say anything about his record. He's done a lot. I forgot which city or town it is. He's from Ohio.
It's Athens, Ohio, yeah.
It's Athens, Ohio. And, you know, I think it's one of the worst counties as far as economic, in the worst economies in the country, in the where he's from. And he's spoken a lot about helping poor people. Like, this dude is... I not that it matters, because I've liked him since I've watched him at LSU, and I've wanted him to succeed, and I really want him to do really well. But if he's able to, you know, have a very successful career, you know, live up to the hype or whatever, the number one pick, be one of those great quarterbacks of his era that we talk about down the road, and he's working in the way that he's been working with like, I would essentially say his human rights advocacy. God, man, he's going to be one of the greats. And I don't want to crown him. Obviously, football is a hard thing to deal with, but I'm saying if he's able to do that and he still continues to climb this mountain that he's been climbing of his advocacy for human rights, he could do some things that are global. And, you know, I'm glad to see that more people in the NFL are speaking out about things that are happening in this country that affect people that they work with every day.
How do you think, when everybody's back in, and we're assuming it's going to be at the end of July, how do you think locker rooms are going to reckon with these things? Because they are melting pots, you know, guys from different backgrounds, different races, everything else. And you played for a lot of different teams, Dante, and, you know, you were with the Patriots during the Spygate year. You were with the Saints during Katrina. You know, nothing with the gravity of the, well, man, Katrina did have the gravity of this, but in a different way. You know, how do you think like a locker room is going to reckon with this? How do you think it'll come up? Everything that's happened in our country since the last time these guys saw each other.
I think it's going to be, there's gonna be a lot of conversations. Guys are going to be upset. But you know, it has been a situation where, you know, people will have these intellectual conversations in the locker room. And there are some guys who, you know, who follow, the politics of this country and have been following it and know a lot. And there are a lot of guys in the locker room who don't know or don't care to know. And that's, you know, that's a typical locker room. But I will say that, over the years, my last year in the locker room was 2013. I will say that since I first got into the NFL in 2002 to the time I left the NFL in 2013 as a player, people were becoming more attuned to political issues, not just in this country, but around the globe. And so I can imagine now, you see it on social media where more guys are talking about not just domestic politics, but international politics. Justin Jackson is one guy that comes to mind. He's pretty good at checking the temperature of things and of the political atmosphere, and he understands how this thing works. There's a lot of guys like that, and he's very outspoken about it, and I applaud him for that. But I think that in locker rooms, guys are going to have these conversations. You know, they're going to have these conversations, and who knows how they're going to turn up. You saw when a lot of things were happening in the Eagles locker room, those guys talked a lot about it. You know, Torrey Smith, Chris Long, Malcolm Jenkins, you know, all those guys went down to, you know, their local district attorney's office, their local government buildings, and spoke, had conversations, had meetings with lawmakers there, and had meetings with district attorneys. And, you know, I think that's the move, because from an athlete's perspective, because we have so much power, we have so much political power that it's insane. I didn't realize that when I first moved here in DC, but one little quick story that I'll share is, you know, I had a decent career. I was blessed to play 10 years and, you know, I had some pretty good years and had some not so good years. I'd say I had a, you know, average career overall. I had fun. It was my dream, so I'm totally fine with that. But one of the first times I went to the Pentagon when I was covering, you know, defense news, national security, I was over there, and you know, I'm getting ushered into generals' offices, and all these people are like, "Hey, Dante, what's up, man? What are you doing here?" And I'm like, "How in the hell do these people know who I am?" Like, seriously, I'm like, "They're at the Pentagon, bro. Like, how do they know who I am?" But everyone loves football, dude. Everyone loves football, and the ability that I've been able to have as an NFL player, that's also working in this political space. I've been able to meet with people and meet with sources that, you know, that I never would have imagined, you know, years into my NFL career. And so political capital that the NFL players have is innumerable, and
it's greater than you knew when you were a player, is what you're saying.
It's much more greater than I knew, and I appreciate players that are, you know, taking the initiative to make those moves, because once they start to do that, you see Anquan Boldin as well. I mean, I was there with them. We all went to the Capitol for 3 straight days, and we met with members both sides of the aisle to speak about criminal justice reform for 3 days, and met with, you know, probably 100 members. We met with a couple committees. And then at the end, Anquan and Malcolm testified at the end in front of one of the committees. So that, I think, is something that people should be doing more. And I'm not saying do it for criminal justice reform. That would be great. But if you feel very passionate about something, if you have a foundation, or if you advocate for something regularly, go come to Washington, man. I'll do what I can to help you out. This goes for any NFL player. because we have so much power in this city, and this is the most powerful city in the world. We have so much power in this city that we do not realize that we do, and I hope more guys take the initiative to do that.
So it's like it opens doors, basically. Exactly. It's a door that like most people can't get through, and because you know whoever it is watched you when you were a player or knows of you because of you know how good you were as a player, you're going to be able to get through that door and make a point to that person.
Right. And you know, I played for so many teams, so that helps, you know, because then there's multiple fan bases. So I think maybe that was my real calling, was to play for all these teams, so I could try to do some good out in the world.
Last thing for me, then, like, what do you think the role of? So obviously, Colin Kaepernick's protest, I think brought light to something that we're seeing 4 years later. We probably should have listened to him more than we did as a country. And then, you know, obviously the job that both, you know, Anquan Boldin and Malcolm Jenkins and everyone involved with the Players Coalition has done, in a situation like this where, you know, police brutality is in the forefront of a lot of people's minds, race in our country is in the forefront of a lot of people's minds. How do you see the role, like, and what can they do? Like, what can the Players Coalition do? And what can individual players who might want to saddle up with them, what can they do? Like, what kind of impact do you think NFL players have a chance to make right now?
I think one of the things that players can do is, continue to push for legislation, sweeping legislation, because the piecemeal legislation that we've been, you know, eking out, obviously hasn't been working, because if you look at the body cam requirement, and there was someone who was just killed by police at the protest in I believe in Louisville, where same city where Breonna Taylor was asleep when police busted in the house and began shooting. None of the policemen who were involved in that incident had their body cameras on. None of them did. So this piecemeal legislation that keeps getting issued out is not working, because now it's, you know, absent forensic evidence, you're working against the state. You're literally working against the state to try to prove that they were at fault for this person's death. And it's hard to do that when it's your word against theirs, because as we've seen time and time again, it doesn't matter that you know people are swearing on the Bible. If it suits their agenda, they will lie in court to prove a point or to help get one of their officers out of trouble. So it's hard sometimes, and that's those are the things that people are frustrated about. So sweeping legislation, sweeping criminal justice legislation is one of the ways to go. And like I said, you know, the guys from the Eagles, they went up and they helped get some things passed. I forgot exactly the name of the bill, but they helped get some things passed.
Yeah, that was when they went to Harrisburg on like a Tuesday, yeah. I remember,
exactly.
Right?
Exactly. Yep. Yep. And those things matter. Doug Baldwin was going, speaking to the spent time with the district attorney and the chief of police in Seattle when he was there. And he'd done a lot of work. There are a lot of players that are doing so much work, man, that deserve applause. But I think moving forward is that we've got to demand sweeping legislation, because we can continue to talk about the broken windows, and we can continue to talk about the water bottles being thrown and things like that. But at the end of the day, that is a symptom of a larger problem. And the larger problem is that police brutality has been something that has been happening for a very long time. And it's happening against African-Americans disproportionately. And so until those things stop, and again, the piecemeal legislation isn't working, there has to be sweeping legislation, because of the fact that it's been happening so long, it's rooted in the DNA of the institution of our law enforcement. It's rooted in that institution. And I'm not saying that all law enforcement officers are bad. I have plenty of family and close friends who are in law enforcement. However, the institution of law enforcement in this country has the foundings of it, the roots of it. is still playing out today. And we see it, you know, time and time again. And until there can be justice for, and again, it, you say having justice for someone who's been murdered or killed by police, there is no justice.
There's no fixing that.
Right. Yeah. But to make sure that we don't let their lives, their deaths be in vain, we have to continue to push for sweeping criminal justice legislation and continue to demand what we want, because that's the only way that we're going to be heard is if we go, we vote, you know, local, state, federal, and you push hard for these reforms that are way overdue, decades overdue.
You know, the crazy thing about it to me is like, that helps the good cops. You know what I mean? That helps the good. It helps the good police officers if those sorts of things are in place. You know, it like the people who are doing the job the right way, that'll help them be seen in the right light. And I don't know. I mean, like it's funny because, you know, where it sort of hit me was Saturday morning. I wake up and I got three kids and my 5-year-old is my oldest, and he sees car burning on TV, and he's like a 5-year-old boy, so yeah. You know, he thinks fire's cool, and so he points at the TV and he says, "What's that?" And I just kind of like didn't know what to tell him.
Yeah, right.
And then I thought, like, I was like, "That's really bad, buddy." And I just turned it, because he's not old enough to comprehend, And so I turned it off, and I just thought about some of my friends I grew up with and how much more complicated a conversation that is for them. If you have African American children, how much more complicated of a conversation that might be. And I reached out to some of my friends and asked them about it, and I started to think about all the second chances I've gotten in my life,
right?
And would those second chances have been available to me if, and I talked about this off the top of the show, like, would all of those second chances have been available to me if I wasn't a white male? So it's just, there's all these things that sort of rush through your head when something like this happens, mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. So, all right. Well, you gave us more time than I had even anticipated, but I always appreciate it, Dante. He's Dante Stallworth. You can follow him on Twitter at Dante Stallworth. Do you have an Instagram?
Yeah, same. It's at Dante Stallworth. Yeah.
At Dante Stallworth. Okay. And you can catch him on CNN. Dante, always appreciate catching up with you.
Al, thanks for having me, brother.
Let's take a moment to breathe. Deep inhale. Extend your spine. Remain focused on what you're doing. If safe to do so, exhale slowly, leaning to one side. Inhale back to center. If safe to do so, exhale slowly to the opposite side. Find mental health resources at loveyourmindtoday.org. This message is brought to you by the Huntsman Mental Health Institute and the Ed Council.
If you love sports and true crime, then there's a new podcast from executive producer Dan Patrick and hosted by me, Jay Harris, that you won't want to miss. Playing Dirty Sports Scandals. Each week, I'm squeezing the juiciest details from some of the biggest sports scandals ever. I'm talking Marcus Dixon, Olympic gymnastics, Cain Velasquez, salacious Super Bowl-level scandals. Join me on the dark side of sports by listening to Playing Dirty Sports Scandals on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
What's up, everybody? This is Stephen A. Smith. When I'm not at my day job, First Take, you can find me in my studio hosting the Stephen A. Smith Show podcast. Tune in every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, at the very least, as I bring you all new episodes that feature the biggest headlines in the world of sports, pop culture, business, and politics. You'll hear my unfiltered opinions on those nauseating Cowboy fans, the chaos in Washington, D.C., and trending topics on social media, as well as my straight shooter interviews with top celebrities and game changers. And I occasionally give out love advice. Yes, it's true. If you want to know my true feelings about something, I'll give it to you straight. So listen to the Stephen A. Smith Show podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcast.
Hey, everyone. This is Molly and Matt, and we're the hosts of Grown Up Stuff, How to Adult, a podcast from Ruby Studio and iHeart Podcasts.
It's a show dedicated to helping you figure out the trickiest parts of adulting.
Like how to start planning for retirement, creating a healthy skincare routine, understanding when and how much to tip someone, and so much more.
We're back with season 2 of the podcast, which means more opportunities to glow up and become a more responsible and better adult, one life lesson at a time.
And let me just tell you, this show is just as much for us as it is for you. So let's figure this stuff out together. This season, we're going to talk about whether or not we're financially and emotionally ready for dog ownership.
We're going to figure out the benefits of a high-yield savings account.
And what exactly are the duties of being a member of the wedding party?
All that plus so much more.
Let's learn about all of it and then some. Listen to Grown Up Stuff How to Adult on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Grown Up Stuff.
MTV's official Challenge podcast is back for another season.
And guess what? So are we.
Just in case you forgot, I'm Tori Deal. I'm a 6-time finalist and a Challenge champion.
And I'm Anissa Ferrer, and I've been gracing your screens for the last 2 decades. I am a veteran challenger and Challenge All-Star.
And speaking of All-Stars, All-Stars 4 is finally here.
I'm going to be honest. I literally thought this day was never going to come.
Well, the Challenge gods have answered our prayers, and we're going to be right here along with you fans covering every episode on the podcast.
And this season takes it to a whole new level. Old school legends, modern power players, redemption seekers, and ex-lovers are all competing in Cape Town, South Africa for the prize of $300,000.
Anyone can win, relationships matter, and only one all-star will claim the title of Challenge Champion.
Listen to MTV's official Challenge podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
All right, appreciate Dante coming out. That was obviously outstanding. He's great on these matters, and just a really good dude who, you know, I think has transitioned really, really well into post-football life, and a lot of football players could learn stuff from him. We're going to jump into the six-pack. I do want to get to your football questions. You guys know how this works. Every week, we put the call out for questions out on Twitter. I pick six. If I pick yours, you get an answer here. This, of course, is in place, or has been in place during the pandemic, for what we were doing earlier, which was the voicemails and the emails. So we'll jump right in. Question number one, this is from Jay Pagan. It's at @just_pagan. Why do you feel it is important to talk about sports when the world has bigger issues in the forefront? Good to see you don't care. I'm not putting this in front of anything else. Like, I don't think talking about football is more important than what's going on in the world, but I do know why people are here. People are here to talk football. And so I'm happy to give them the chance to come here and listen to some stuff on football and weave the other stuff in. So to get to the football stuff, you do have to listen to some of the other stuff, which is sort of how I wanted to put this week's podcast together, because there are important issues going on in the world. Question number two, that's from SRNY10 at Sham Here Rosen, if two, I think. You think there's going to be NFL fans? There's going to be fans at NFL games this season? I think it's going to vary from stadium to stadium. I do not think that we're going to have full stadiums across the league by the end of the year. Not saying it's impossible. I don't know what the future looks like. I don't have a crystal ball, but I don't think that every city in the league is going to be in a place to host to have stadiums full by December. They may prove me wrong. I think at the beginning of the season, there's going to be inequities across the league. And I think the one reason why they're going to be okay going forward like that is because it's simple. It's because of the money. And, you know, if you look at the way that the NFL is structured, the way the salary cap works, it's pretty easy here. Everyone is at risk of losing money if you are not willing to do what's allowable in some states, even if the same things aren't allowable in other states. And so what I mean by that, the salary cap, which dictates how much players make, is a percentage of total revenue. If total revenue is hurt, that hurts the owners, of course, because that's their bottom line, but it also hurts the players because it's going to hurt the percentage coming back to them. So what's the best way you can do to try to preserve as much revenue as you possibly can? It's going to be to try to get fans in the stands as best you can in the places that you can do it. And so, you know, I think there's certainly a possibility that, you know, we get to September and maybe you've got a half full stadium in Kansas City and you're playing in an empty stadium at the Meadowlands and an empty stadium in LA. And I think the reason why teams would be willing to do that again is because the total revenue equation is going to affect the total revenue equation, and the total revenue equation affects everyone. So my guess is that there are going to be inequities probably throughout the fall from city to city, but I do think there will be fans in the stands in some places to begin with, and probably some fans in the stands everywhere by the end, but I don't think we'll have full stadiums everywhere at the end. Question number three from Connecty, that's Connecty22, at Connecty22. What division do you think is the toughest to win this year in the NFL, and who do you think will win that division? Connecty, I'm going to tell you right now, I believe it's the NFC West, which is the easy answer. But if you look at it, I think Arizona is going to be better than a lot of people think. I think the Rams, as long as Sean McVay is there, and they do have some holes right now, they're going to be competitive. How far they can go, I think, is going to depend on their offensive line. And then San Francisco and Seattle are legit contenders, with San Francisco, I think, is the favorite to win that division. Question number four from Gregory Schillinger. That's at Gregory Schillen. Really wondering if we have two or four preseason games this year. More importantly, will we have two going forward in the years to come? Okay, the first part of your question, I think we will have four preseason games this year. Again, my answer on that question is driven by the revenue equation. Where teams are going to be hurting is on the local revenue end. Preseason games are enormously important to local revenue because they have television deals that are connected to that. And so my guess is we do get four preseason games this year. As for the question of two going forward, the plan that I've heard is that instead of going from 16-4 preseason games to 17-2, I've heard the plan would be to go 17-3. With the option to eventually cut that down to two. Again, this is all driven by money. I think ultimately what you'll see is probably the emphasis on joint practices, whenever it's okay to do that again, the emphasis on joint practices getting ramped up a little bit. And that eventually probably replaces the extra preseason game. But I think for right now, as long as it's 16 games, you'll have four preseason games. And then when they go to 17 games, I think you'll see it goes to three preseason games and then maybe eventually to two. Question number five from Nathan Haneka. Do you think the billionaire owners are currently quite pleased at their successful blackballing of Kaepernick? Surely his situation has silenced a lot of voices in the NFL who would otherwise be speaking out right now. Nathan, I think it's the opposite. I think some of the owners have their heels dug in and are hardcore against what Kaepernick did, and those owners probably haven't budged much. But I think there are some owners that are regretful over the way the league handled it. And I'll give you guys an interesting story of how a situation was handled 2 years before Kaepernick that could have created at least a roadmap for how they handle this one. You guys may remember in 2014, Michael Sam was drafted, and there was a lot of questions at the time about the Rams doing a deal with Roger Goodell to make sure that he did not go undrafted because he had been the SEC Defensive Player of the Year. Remember, he'd come out, first openly gay player in the NFL, and so, you know, he goes through Rams camp. He doesn't wind up making the team. And so when he got cut, there was, I think, some concern across the NFL how it was going to look if he just sort of vanished from football. And so if you remember earlier that offseason, there had been some stuff that had happened with Jerry Jones. And, you know, the league basically called in a favor to the Cowboys. This was how the story went. and Michael Sam wound up on the roster. And I know that there was, I don't know the particulars of the deal, but I do remember hearing from people in the building that they had to have Sam around for a certain amount of time. And so that was a way of, I think, sort of the league trying to sidestep a public relations problem. And, you know, bottom line is they manufactured his way onto a team. And, you know, things wound up, you know, I think Michael Sam had his own issues, and there were people that didn't like him, didn't like the way he conducted himself, showed up late to stuff, everything else. But, you know, I think ultimately the league was sort of worried about the fallout if Michael Sam didn't get a fair shot. And so, you know, I think at the very least, there are some people who are regretful that they didn't maybe try to manufacture a similar sort of situation for Kaepernick, whether it would have worked or not. You know, at the time, no one knows. But the fact that they didn't do more to make sure that, you know, this issue didn't become a bigger one, I think that there's some regret over that. I do think that it's like I reported at the time, the fact that he wasn't a starting quarterback, the fact that he wasn't considered a starting caliber quarterback anymore kind of became the issue, because when you're bringing in a backup quarterback, it's like, okay, like now we're willing to bring in a lot less as far as stuff that's outside of football with a player. And most teams would look at, like, I remember the Seahawks came in, and the Seahawks had him in for a visit, and they, you know, the whole thing blew up and it became a big deal and everything else. And I know part of the thought for the Seahawks was, well, you know, like, we had Austin Davis in too and nobody cared, so just give me Austin Davis. You like, a lot of these teams just want the backup quarterback to blend in with the furniture. And so I think that there was like an element there with Kaepernick after, you know, it was just, I think there were owners who wanted to sign him, but it was just sort of became one of those like not in my backyard type of things. You know, as for his situation, silencing other players, I think the opposite's happened. I think he has given players cover to speak out. Like, and I think he's sort of normalized the idea of players speaking out in social issues. So I actually think he's empowered other guys to talk. I think he's pushed other guys. I think his whole situation pushed other guys to talk. And so, I mean, to me, I think in that way he's actually helped other players. Finally, question number 6. This is from Jay Doe. That's at Hopkins Horns. Rookie running back most likely to break 1,000 all-purpose yards this season, and potential comeback players of the year. You know, I would love to see someone like Alex Smith win comeback player of the year. I don't think he's gonna play again, but like to have some sort of story like that would be fun. As for the player most likely to break 1,000 all-purpose yards this season, I'll take you through some of the names. I don't know that there's going to be the amount of opportunity for Edwards-Helaire in Kansas City. DeAndre Swift, you know, if Kerryon Johnson's healthy, is probably splitting time with Kerryon Johnson. I look at, you know, Cam Akers with the Rams. I think he makes an impact, but he's splitting time with Daryl Henderson in all likelihood. J.K. Dobbins splitting time with Mark Ingram. You get the picture. A lot of these guys are going to be in platoons. The one I would keep an eye on is Jonathan Taylor. He was such a dominant player in college, 6,000 yards, playing behind a dominant offensive line in Indianapolis. And I think he's going to have a chance to prove he's better than Marlon Mack and the rest of the crew there. So Jonathan Taylor would be a name that I would watch as a guy who I think is going to get a lot of opportunity. I know you said all-purpose, and maybe he's not as refined a receiver as some of the other guys. I just think Jonathan Taylor is going to see the ball quite a bit. Appreciate you guys coming out again. And if you made it this deep into the podcast, I appreciate you guys sticking with us through, obviously, what was a little bit of a different podcast. Hopefully you learned something from Dante. Hopefully we gave you a little bit of football there to chew on as well. Always want your feedback, so let me know how we did this week and every week. You guys know where to find me on social media, at Albert Breer on Twitter, at Albert R. Breer on Facebook, at Albert_Breer on Instagram, and always listen to all of our podcasts. You got the Jenny and Connor Weekside podcast twice a week now. We do the Week in Review podcast as a group. Sometimes Gary's podcast posts on Mondays. You can get all those podcasts in one place on the MMQB NFL podcast feed. Find that on Spotify, Stitcher, TuneIn, Google Play, Apple Podcasts, wherever you guys get your shows. Same time next week. I'll see you guys then.
Check the back seat. Check the back seat.
All right, come here.
Check the back seat.
Gets in your head, right? Good. Because every year, dozens of children are forgotten in the backseat of a car by a parent or caregiver. All never thought it could happen to them. But with changes in routines, distractions, or a sleeping child, it can happen to anyone. Parked cars get hot, fast, and can be deadly. So get it in your head.
Check the back seat.
A message from NHTSA and the Ad Council.
If you love sports and true crime, then there's a new podcast from executive producer Dan Patrick and hosted by me, Jay Harris, that you won't want to miss. Playing Dirty Sports Scandals. Each week, I'm squeezing the juiciest details from some of the biggest sports scandals ever. I'm talking Marcus Dixon, Olympic gymnastics, Cain Velasquez, salacious Super Bowl-level scandals. Join me on the dark side of sports by listening to Playing Dirty Sports Scandals on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
What's up, everybody? This is Stephen A. Smith, host of the Stephen A. Smith Show podcast. Tune in every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday at the very least as I bring you all new episodes that feature the biggest headlines in the world of sports, pop culture, business, and I answer your phone calls and respond to your tweets. You'll hear my unfiltered opinions and straight-shooter interviews with top celebrities and game changers, all that and more. So listen to the Stephen A. Smith Show podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcast.
MTV's official Challenge podcast is back for another season.
And so are we.
I'm Tori Deal.
And I'm Anissa Ferreira.
The wait is over, guys. All Stars 4 is finally here.
And this season takes it to a whole new level. Old school legends, modern power players, and ex-lovers are all competing in Cape Town, South Africa for the prize of $300,000.
And we're going to be right here along with you fans, covering every episode on the podcast.
Listen to MTV's official Challenge podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey everyone, this is Molly and Matt, and we're the hosts of Grown Up Stuff, How to Adult, a podcast from Ruby Studio and iHeart Podcasts.
It's a show dedicated to helping you figure out the trickiest parts of adulting.
Like how to start planning for retirement, creating a healthy skincare routine, understanding when and how much to tip someone, and so much more.
Let's learn about all of it and then some. Listen to Grown Up Stuff, How to Adult on America's number one podcast network, iHeart. Open your free iHeart app and search Grown Up Stuff.
Grown Up Stuff.